Now, I want that to sink into you. I'll give you an example. I do not know Governor Kemp personally. I know some things about him, and I like him. He has made campaign promises, and he's trying to fulfill those. I think that the time before the virus hit, before the state had to shut down a little bit for a few months, I was in a meeting. Chad and I went down to a pastor's day down in Atlanta, and the governor came and spoke to us and talked to us a little bit about what he and his wife are involved in. And one of the things, his wife's name is Marty, one of the things that the governor and his wife are involved in is trying to shut down the human trafficking that is coming through Georgia. I like that. I like the fact that he doesn't crawdad on being a born-again Christian. I like that. But can I tell you that I don't have his personal cell phone number? I don't have the ability to just say, well, I'll put him on speed dial. Governor, hey, this is Tom. I don't know him that well. Now, I know some things about him, and the things I know I like. Now, there may be some things come out in the future that I don't like. But right now, I like him pretty well. But unless he calls me and says, hey, put me in your phone, he and I will not be close personal friends. But if you look at our chapter, for 6 weeks now, today is the sixth week. If you look at our chapter, what you will see is that the first 3.5 verses, the first 3.5, you will see that he is talking about the Lord. The last 2.5 verses, he's not speaking about the Lord. Everything flips and he begins to talk to the Lord. If you would look with me at the middle of verse 4, he says, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest the table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. And I think that verse number 6, which is where we are at today, is just a continuation of that personal, I guess, approach to God. And so, with that in mind, I want us to look at three things this morning. The first thing that I want you to look at is I want you to look at God's personality. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me. That's the first thing that I want you to focus on this morning. Surely goodness and mercy. What is goodness and mercy? Can I tell you that those are attributes of God? Now, if you do a search, you can put a search engine on it if you want to, but you will come up with about 15 different attributes of God. These are things that make up the personality or the character of God. You have things like he is self-existent. What do I mean by that? Everything that you see had a beginning. But yet, God did not have a beginning. Because you see, from a logical standpoint, there had to be something that was self-existent for everything else to build off of. Houses do not get built by themselves. Trees do not get cut and turned into lumber by themselves. One of the most asinine theories that ever came out about the creation of this whole world was the Big Bang theory. How that there was an explosion and all of a sudden, look what we've got. Well, I've seen some explosions. When I was a kid, we would take cherry bombs and sometimes we would take M80s. And sometimes we would even tape them together and put them under a bucket and watch that bucket just boom and head up. There were times when I heard of people in high school, I would have never done this, where that they would be in a bathroom, maybe a boy's bathroom, and they would drop a cherry bomb in, out the door they would go, and about 15 seconds later, you got water and maybe porcelain all over the bathroom. I never did that. I'm not lying, but I've known people that have. I hung out with them. But we have seen explosions. I mean, you've watched the old Westerns and they've got the nitro on the wagon and you're trying not to rattle it so it don't go up. All right? I've never seen a house built from an explosion. I've never seen an automobile get fixed through some type of explosion. Now, I've seen them get destroyed by fire. A few days ago, we were cutting grass at our house. First of it, it happened to Deb before her surgery. And then I was cutting grass later. And the next thing I know, we got fire on the engine of the lawnmower. The first time, Chad ran out there and got Deb to cut it off and got her off the lawnmower. And then I thought, okay, we'll clean it. So we cleaned it really well. I got on it and we're riding around. All of a sudden, I'm smelling something. Chad's not around. He wants me to get burned up. Right? I'm smelling something and I'm thinking, I better look. So I kill the blades and put the power or the parking brake on. And I hopped off and sure enough, there's flames coming off the side of the motor. What had happened was, It had a couple of blown head gaskets and oil was leaking out. Can I tell you that that fire did not fix the head gaskets? I had to have a repair shop do that. And so when you look at the self-existence of God, you've just got to understand there's got to be something at the very beginning that began it. And it takes a lot less faith to believe that there is a creator that was self-existent than something that came from nothing. Are you going to get $1 million in your checking account if you got zero in it? No. And so he's self-existent. What else some things? Quickly. He's omniscient. He's omnipotent. He's omnipresent. He is holy. He is just. He is loving. All of those things are great. And there's 15 of these. But the two that David focuses on this morning, and as we have read this our whole lives, and as generations before us have read this, David focuses on two things. He focuses on goodness, and he focuses on mercy. Now, what do I mean by goodness? I mean that I guess the definition of that would be kindness in action. Psalm 34:8 says, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." Now, you're looking at a preacher, you're looking at a Christian that can testify of the goodness of God. Now, let me ask you a question. Has God been good in your life? You think about the times that you sinned willfully. There wasn't a lightning bolt that came out of heaven and zapped you. It was the goodness of God that showed you mercy. The goodness of God, according to the book of Romans, is to drive us to repentance. There is nothing that is not good about God. Even his chastening is good for us. Even when we are disciplined, that is good for us. And so, oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Micah 7:18 says this, "Who is a God like unto thee that pardoneth iniquity?" Think about the times that you've made those godless decisions in your life. And yet, when you ask for forgiveness, he passed judgment off onto his son, so that you and me in those sinful times would never have to pay for those sins. He passeth by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage. He retaineth not his anger forever. Why? Because he delighteth in mercy. When you think about this, and I'm one, I thought I put another slide in there and I didn't. When you think about this, I want you to think about our sheep analogy. Now, I told you last week that I felt like that the metaphor changed from sheep, shepherd, to a lord or a homeowner, a property owner that wanted to have a banquet, and he brought us in and he prepared a table before us. But I also talked about how that the shepherd would take those sheep sometimes through the valley of the shadow, those tight places where the dens and the lairs with the wild animals would be ready to pounce. But the shepherd had already found the safe way. We talked a little bit about that a couple of weeks ago. And so we see that. And I think today we could probably say, well, you've got goodness and you've got mercy, and the shepherd has led them there. He's prepared a table before them. But now the sheep are looking and they're going, we've got a good shepherd. We've got a merciful shepherd. Douglas MacMillan is an old-time Scottish preacher. And he's probably most well known for a book that he wrote in the late 70s. It's called The Lord is Our Shepherd. When I came across that book this week, and I'm interested in reading the book. But I came across the story that's in this book, and it has to do with an old Scottish man that was a shepherd, and he had gotten saved. He had never been trained officially in a seminary. Doctrinally, he would have probably not been at the top of his class, so to speak, because he didn't even go to class. But this old shepherd had been saved, and God had called him to preach. And MacMillan said, I went to hear the old shepherd preach. And he began to tell the story about the 12 years that he was a sheep herder. He said, I always walked in front. And I mentioned that earlier in the six-part series here, that the shepherd was always in the front. And he said, I would always walk in the front, and behind me the sheep would follow. And he said, sheep are not the brightest animals. Sometimes these animals, they think that they're smarter than the shepherd. And they are apt, if they see something out of their vision, maybe out of their peripheral vision, they see some grass, and they go, hey, let's go there. And the shepherd is going this way, and they just kind of veer off. He said, but I had something that came up at the rear of the flock. He said, without even looking back, without whistling, I had two sheepdogs. One of those dogs would be on the left, one would be on the right, and would one of those rams or one of those ewes, if they began to divert, one of those sheepdogs would get around and look at it and force it back to the flock. He said, if another one on the other side began to try to do the same thing, the other dog would go and it would herd it back to the flock. And the old preacher said, those two dogs, he said, they are like the goodness and the mercy of God. That's where the title of the message came from. God's goodness and God's mercy are like two angels. I heard about one preacher that said that he drove so fast that he had to have two angels, mercy and goodness, on his front fenders. MacMillan made this statement. He said, I never got over that sermon. And he said, if I ever have two sheepdogs, their names are going to be goodness and mercy. And all I'm thinking is, we don't have any dogs. I'm not wanting any dogs. But I didn't want the last three we had. But if we ever get dogs again, those might be good names. Goodness and mercy. Now, we one of the last dogs we had, they wasn't nothing good about that dog. As a matter of fact, preacher used to say that that dog wants a piece of me. Every time preacher would come over to the house, that dog would be going, growling at him. And so, McMillan said, it's like those sheep dogs. And when I began to just visualize this and thought about the goodness of God in my own life, how can, even in the bad times, how can I have anything but love for God? The times that have been the hardest, God has still shown himself good. And God has still shown himself merciful. And so, we see God's personality. God is good. God is merciful. But there's a second thing that I want you to see this morning. In verse number 6, look at the middle part of it. It says this, that surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Now, David is at the end of his life. I do not believe that David wrote this at the beginning of his life when he was just a young person. The things that you look at here when it talks about, I will dwell in the house of the Lord, which is my third point, I believe that he has written this as he's an older man. And he has had ups and he has had downs his whole life. I mean, he had the lot of being the youngest boy in his father's house. Being the youngest boy, he always got the worst jobs. And one of the lowest jobs that a boy in Israel could have would be to go and live with the sheep. Take care of the sheep, make sure that they were grazing, make sure that they were watered, make sure that they were sheared. All of those things would go to the least boy. His brothers wouldn't respect him, and here he is, he's just a kid. But yet, while he is out there in the wilderness, tending to those sheep, somehow God works in his soul. And God begins to just do things and give him abilities that his older brothers don't have. I mean, he's got the ability to sing. He's got the ability to write songs. He's got the ability to play instruments. But not only that, he's got the ability to fight. He fights off a lion. He fights off a bear. He's just a young boy. Well, he's young, he's excited, and all of a sudden there's a fight going on with the Philistines. And he is told by his dad, David, your brothers are over with Saul and they're fighting against the Philistines. Take this bread, take this cheese, and go give it to them to help them out. So off he goes. And as he gets there, he's not hearing anything about fighting. He's seeing the soldier of Israel. They're just kind of sitting around next to their tents. Then he hears about a giant named Goliath. And he'd no more heard about Goliath than he hears Goliath. And he's challenging people. Come out and fight me. If you win, we'll serve you. If I win, you serve us. And David's looking around saying, who's getting him? And his brothers begin to rebuke him. That's a pretty down time. Why don't you shut up? You're just a punk kid. Can I tell you, when God puts something in your heart, I don't care if you're young or if you're old, if it's from God, it's good. I think there's times when there's young people that walk with God and they've got more discernment than their parents. I think there's most of the time that kids don't have more sense than their parents. But every once in a while that takes place. And so you've got David and he's thinking about all the things in his life. One of the things that just came to my mind, that was a downtime for him. It hasn't been that long ago that I preached about David, and he was running from Saul, which he did for like 15 years. And he took refuge with God's enemies. He feigned to be against Israel so that he could have peace from Saul's territory. And the Amalekites, they knew that David was not around. And so what did they do? They attacked David's family and his men's family in a place called Ziklag. They took them captive. They made them slaves. They put them in captivity. They took all of their livestock. And when David and his men came back to Ziklag and they saw that it had been burned and nobody was there, the men thought about killing David. Where's our families? They've been kidnapped. And what did the Bible say? David encouraged himself in the Lord. And you and I, there are times when we've got to encourage ourselves in the Lord because nobody else is doing it. And so David went to the Lord and God gave him a plan. He talked to the men about it, said, "Let's go." There were 600 of them. 200 of them were so tired, they kind of stayed back before the battle took place, and they recovered everybody and everything. And the goodness of God is seen when it looked as though all hope was lost. I look back at my own life and I see this episode and I see this thing that happened. And all I'm thinking is, God brought me through that. God was good to me. God was merciful to me. Not only was God showing me kindness, but he was giving me mercy when he should have given me judgment. Oh, I'm telling you, when you see God pursuing you, I mean, you can look at it and it doesn't matter what time of the year it is. You can look at springtime when hope's springing eternal. I mean, when the weather begins to turn pretty and you can begin to see the flowers begin to bloom, there's something that just kind of swells up on the inside of you and says, get outside and do something. Then you got the summertime and you got people that are excited and they're going to the beaches and they're going to the mountains and they're going to each other's house and they're having picnics and birthday parties and all of those things. And it's just a good time. But then the fall begins to come into our lives. The grain begins to turn brown. The heat begins to turn cooler. And even though it's feeling good, because 65 degrees is always better than 95, even though it's getting cooler, you know what's coming next. You know it won't be long before the trees won't have any leaves on them. The only green thing you're going to see is the evergreens. Most of your grasses, unless it's a rye, they're going to turn brown. And so you begin to see things wane. The wintertime comes. Everything's icy. Everything's frozen. It looks as though that life will never happen again. But then spring comes. It's a cycle. And you and I, we go through cycles in our life. There are times when we are on the mountaintop, we are walking with God, and everything seems to be clicking. And then there are other times when it's wintertime, and you're in the valley, and it's as though nothing you do is right. It's like every endeavor ends in a failure. But I've lived long enough, and some of you have lived long enough to learn this truth. The things that I have thought were the worst in my life, in a lot of instances, have turned out to be the best things in my life. You've got to let some time pass, and then you'll be able to see maybe the workings of God in a little better way. And so, God pursues us with goodness and mercy. Now, a question that I want to ask you. As God pursues us with goodness and mercy, what should we do? Well, you say, well, I'm hoping to accept it. I am too. But after we accept it, what are we to do then? Can I tell you that you and I ought to be passing goodness and mercy along to other people? You ought to be consciously looking to see how you can be good, acts of kindness to people that you come in contact with. Things that are simple. Letting somebody go before you in line. Letting somebody get into traffic when it's nutty out there. All of those things are just little acts of kindness. God has been so good to us. Can I tell you that I am getting so fanatical about the goodness of God that I thank Him if I make it through a green light without it turning red? Now, you may think that's crazy. But can I tell you that the more I thank God for His goodness and for His mercy, the more confidence that I have in Him? The closer that I live to Him, thanking Him for that stuff, the more I just want to kind of help other people. And can I tell you that when people do kind things for me, I ought to want to be thankful. I ought to be full of gratitude with that. I heard this story about 45 years ago. I heard Dr. Bob Jones III tell this story. He was preaching in a chapel that I was sitting in. And he told a story about a lady that had one of these little dogs that weighs about 3.5 pounds. The dogs I had ate that much for supper. But she had this little dog, and she wasn't holding it. She had it on a little leash, and he said it was one of them little foo-foo type dogs. And said she was kind of a proud lady. And said, I was at the door and I saw her coming, so I just stopped and I opened the door. She walked in with her nose in the air, dragging that little dog behind her. Said she didn't say a word. She didn't say thank you. She didn't say kiss my foot. She didn't say anything. He said, I let her get about 10 steps in there, and I knew she wasn't going to turn around. I said, you're welcome, lady, and so is your kid. We ought to be grateful. We ought to be grateful for what people do for us. We ought to be good in the way that we deal with people, and we ought to show them mercy. Are you harder on other people than you are on yourself? If you are, you're wrong. If you're harder on somebody else than you are on yourself, you got it inverted. We ought to be giving mercy when mercy's not really due, because that's the whole definition of mercy. God not giving us what we deserve. And so God pursues us. Let me give you a third thing this morning. I want you to see God's pledge. Look at the latter part. Of verse 6. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, there's two ways to look at this little phrase. I will dwell in the house of the Lord. The Hebrew word for dwell has the idea of I will return to the house of the Lord. Now, was the house of the Lord special for David? You bet it was. As a matter of fact, David reserved the highest point in Old Jerusalem so that that could be the place where God's temple was going to be built. David, as the king, he took the second highest place because he wanted God to have the pinnacle. And he wanted to build that temple so bad. But yet, the goodness of God would not let him build it. Why did God tell him he didn't do it? Or he couldn't do it? His hands were too bloody. He said, but David, I tell you what I'll do. I'll let your son do it. I will let Solomon build it, but you can raise the money and you can collect the materials and we'll let your boy do it. David wanted that so, so bad. The goodness of God would not let him. He loved going to the tabernacle, which was basically a tent, but it was the place where God was at. You see, God dwelt on the Ark of the Covenant, on the mercy seat where the angels' wings were touching toward each other. That was where the presence of God was at in ancient Israel. And later, it would go from the tabernacle to the temple, and the presence of God would be there. That would be God's house. But David, he was not allowed. But yet, that was still the goodness of God. When David was ran out of his own kingdom by his own son Absalom, when he crossed that Kidron Brook, and he looks back at Jerusalem, there's something inside of him that is just breaking. Why? Because his boy has rebelled against him. But yet, as he writes this psalm now, after those days have passed, he said, the goodness and the mercy of God have followed me, and I will dwell. In other words, I'm going to return to the house of God, where I have always loved going. Psalm 122 says, I was glad when they said, let us go to the house of the Lord. And I'm telling you right now, if a person names the name of Christ, they ought to want to be at God's house. If you don't want to go to church, you better do some spiritual checking up. Church is something that you ought to love. Now, there are times when people cannot come to church anymore. Maybe they're elderly or maybe they are infirmed, but if you can, you should. And so you've got God's pledge. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I told you there were two ways to look at this verse. Not only was David looking forward to getting back to that tabernacle where that the Sabbath day would be honored and God's word would be read, and the glory of God would be on display, and the worship of God would be among his people. But when it uses the word forever, he's talking about living with the Lord after he dies. And so, he's excited about going to the house of God while he's living. Oh, but he's looking forward to the day when he's at God's house, in God's abode. And so he says, I will dwell in the house of Jehovah forever. No matter what comes, God is with us. Job said this in Job 23. Let me just put my glasses on. I didn't share a slide with this, I don't think. Check it and see. Yeah, I did. Okay. You can read this with me. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there. And I want you to place yourself in Job's spot here. I go forward, God's not there. And backward, but I cannot perceive him. In other words, it doesn't seem like he's there to catch me. Look on the left hand where he doth work, but I can't behold him. I look out there, I don't see him there. So, I mean, he's not here, he's not here, he's not here. And he said, he hideth himself on the right hand that I cannot see him. But I want you to see Job's faith. I want you to see Job's understanding. But he, God, knoweth the way that I take, and when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. When you do not see God in front, in back, to your left, to your right, Don't ever think that God is not there. He is there. We worry about all kind of stuff. For many years, we had a secretary at our church, Miss Annette Hicks. Miss Hicks died a couple of years ago. We had her funeral, and at the graveside, her grandson had the graveside part of her funeral. And he was talking about his Myrna. And he made this statement, and I've never forgotten it. And I saw Marty, I don't know, 3 months ago. And I told him, I said, Marty, I remember what you said at your grandmother's funeral. And he said, that was true, wasn't it, Brother Tommy? I said, oh yeah, it was true. What Marty said is he was standing next to the coffin before they planted Miss Hicks. He said, for those of you that knew my Myrna, you know she was a professional worrier. And that's true. She worried about her kids. She worried about her grandkid. She has one. That was Marty. She worried about the church finances because she was the church secretary. If she was a nickel off, she had spent 3, 4, 5 hours trying to find that nickel and balancing the books. I mean, she worried about stuff. Oh, but she's not worrying today. She's with the Lord. And so sometimes we worry about things instead of just saying, Lord, you got to take care of this. I'm telling you, in the last 6 months, there's been a lot of things that I've said, Lord, this is your job. I don't have enough sense to handle it. You're going to have to do this. And can I tell you that there's been a peace? There's been a confidence that it's going to be okay because the Lord's in control. I don't know what will happen tomorrow. I didn't know what was going to happen today. I mean, I planned for stuff, but that can all flip on a, you know, with a switch. And so, we have a tendency to worry, but we ought to have our confidence in the Lord. B.B. Warfield was probably the greatest theologian that Princeton ever had. And if you don't know this, the Ivy League schools were actually begun by godly men. Now, they're bastions of liberalism and leftism nowadays. But at the beginning, these schools, they were rabid fundamentalists is what they were. They loved their Bibles. And B.B. Warfield was one of those theologians that was at Princeton. B.B. Warfield met a young lady. Her name was Annie. They got married and they decided that what they would do is they would go to Germany on their honeymoon. And as they boarded the boat and they got to Germany, they had no more gotten to Germany to celebrate their honeymoon than they were caught in a violent storm and lightning struck her and she was an invalid the rest of her life. For 35 years, B.B. Warfield took care of his new bride. And somebody asked him, they said, you were young. And he said, the goodness and the mercy of God had been extended to me. I was simply extending it to a person that I love. I wonder how many people today, how many young people today would have the commitment on their honeymoon if one of them was smitten with a paralysis, where that they would be bedridden or chair ridden for the rest of their life, how long would they stay with that person? If we accept the goodness and the mercy of God, we ought to fulfill our vow. When I think about the goodness and mercy of God, I cannot help but think about home. I can't help but think about my childhood. And some of you had marvelous childhoods. Now, some of you had horrible childhoods. Do you remember one of the verses in our psalm today? When mother and father forsake me, the Lord will lift me up. Well, can I tell you this, that I didn't ever suffer any kind of abuse. And when I think of home, I think of that little pink house. Yes, I lived in a pink house. 900 square foot cinder block house, concrete blocks. But I can still see my dad and my mom sitting at that little table in the kitchen. The washing machine was on the other side of the refrigerator. My mama had the dryer in the bathroom because the house was so little. Oh, but I think about that old house and how that it was a good place. I can still visualize, if I close my eyes and I think about it, I can still walk down that hallway. I can flip that little old baby air conditioner that was in my window. I could flip that thing on. I could shut my door. And in about 10 minutes, that room would be cool. And I could hop up in that bed, get on my back, and just kind of move around a little bit. I can still tell you what that mattress feels like today. Why? Because it was a good time. And I can't tell you the number of times that mercy was extended to me. I loved home. We celebrated moms and dads today. One of the beautiful things that I have always loved in the past few years, I have loved the way that Miss Sarah's kids have loved her. Miss Sarah Jordan's kids love their mama. They love their daddy. Now, he's with the Lord today. But Miss Sarah, she is loved by her kids. I think about some of you and you miss your daddy today. You think about how good he was. And every time I think about that, all I think about is that song that old Gomer Powell used to sing, "Oh, my papa, he was so good to me." You know, that guy, he could act crazy, but I'm telling you, that guy was a good singer. There's coming a day when we're going to go to the Lord's house. And everything's better at the Lord's house. I'm looking forward at some point in the future to being in the Lord's house. Now, I look forward every week of being in this house. But can I tell you, this house is not the house of God for the New Testament Christian. The house of God is you. If you have Christ in your heart, you're the house of God. Now, we come together collectively, and I love coming together collectively, and God willing, we'll have more people collecting soon. But there's coming a day when there's going to be a grand reunion. And all God's people from every corner of the earth that named the name of Christ, we're going to meet together with the Lord in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Now, what do we do until then? Romans 12:1 tells us this. I beseech you, brethren, I beg you, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present yourself a living sacrifice. That means that God has extended His mercy. He has extended His goodness, His kindness to us. The least we can do is give ourselves to Him and say, Lord, I'm yours. I'll do whatever you want me to do. There is nothing more joyous than being in the perfect will of God for our lives. Are you there this morning? God's two sheepdogs, goodness and mercy. Are you seeing those in your life? Are you extending that to others?